The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. We are reading today from the May 2019 edition of Smithsonian. At the edge of the ice, deep inside the Arctic Circle, Intuit hunters embrace modern technology but preserve a traditional way of life. Photographs by Henrik Saxgren, text by Minik Rosing. And the title is written across two pages that give you a chill to look at it, presumably in the Arctic, very cold. And there's a hunter, his name is Kwamagapik, age 16, and he hunts seals near Thule. Inuit were exempted from the 2010 European Union law banning the trade of seal products. When I was a small child in the late 1950s, my family lived on a reindeer farm in the fjords of Greenland. My father, Jens Rosing, had deep roots in the country. Some of his ancestors were Inuits who'd come over from Canadian islands. Some of his ancestors were Inuits who'd come over from Canadian islands 800 years earlier. Others were Danes who'd arrived in the early 1800s, just after the Napoleonic Wars. In addition to breeding reindeer, my father was painting, drawing, and writing books. He also made small pictures of seals, sled dogs, polar bears, and other iconic Greenland scenes. There was plenty of wilderness around our home, but there was no school, so we moved to Denmark, where my mother's family lived. But we always felt drawn to Greenland. When I was a teenager, my father became the director of the Greenland National Museum and Archives in Nuuk, N-U-U-K. Soon after that, I moved to a small settlement just north of the Arctic Circle, where I worked as a substitute teacher and line-fished halibut from a dog sled. I became a geologist, mainly because I loved spending time outdoors in Greenland. There's no place on Earth I find more tranquil. When I took a group of students there recently to do field work, one of them remarked, "It's a long day when you're alone with yourself. In Greenland, you can really experience what it's like. In Greenland, you can really experience what that's like. Even though the climate is harsh, you can live independently, as long as you don't do anything stupid. When you live in a city, your survival depends on everyone else around you not being stupid. It's a mistake, though, to think of Greenland as isolated." There's a stereotype of Inuit people who live out in the middle of nowhere and go outside to knock some animal on the head and eat it raw. In reality, Greenland has a literacy rate of 100%, and its people have plenty of knowledge and opinions about the rest of the world. The major classic novels were translated into Greenlandic and read widely starting in the mid-1800s. Robinson Crusoe ran as a serial in the newspaper. These days, even the most remote houses are usually connected to the Internet. My grandfather, Otto Rosing, captured the contradiction between remoteness and worldliness back in 1943, when he was a pastor assigned to the Lutheran Church in Thule. In a letter around that time, he described an afternoon outing with his family on a small motorboat when a flotilla of ships from Washington, D.C. suddenly appeared. Ready to set up a large new weather and radio station. Although my grandfather was just a local pastor, He told the Americans they weren't authorized to make landfall from the United States without government approval. Greenland is the land of surprises these days, he wrote. You can live in prehistoric times one day and get entangled in international affairs the next. That radio station expanded into Thule Air Base, the northernmost U.S. military base in the world, and it drew thousands of Americans over the years. They brought a lot of new things to Greenland. Coca-Cola, blue jeans, rock and roll music. You'll hear people lamenting this, saying that the Western world is destroying the Inuit way of life. I find it interesting, though, that when Elvis's music came to Denmark, people didn't think of it as a cultural disaster. Humans everywhere are curious about new gadgets and goods. They're always looking for new inspiration. There are parts of the world where colonizers forced the local people to change their ways of life. For the most part, Greenlanders have had a lot of freedom. To make their own choices. And they've chosen to keep the parts of their own culture that work best for them. Take the man in the opening spread of this story. He's wearing modern boots because they're much more rugged than traditional Inuit footwear. But he's also wearing polar bear skin pants. That's not a fashion statement. He prefers warm water repellent polar bear skin to synthetic alternatives. Choosing the traditional option over the modern one was a practical decision for him. We like to romanticize people who live in the wilderness, but when I lived in Concord, Massachusetts, people like to tell me there was a footpath between Walden Pond and Concord because Henry David Thoreau often went into town to have tea with his friends. He didn't want to sit alone in his cabin all the time. He wanted to interact with other people, to hear new stories and expand his world. Why should we assume the Inuit people of Greenland are any different? That was a short article, but here are some footnotes. Photographer's Notebook. I drove with a hunter, Ilinquag, with his 13 dogs. We were going on a narwhal hunt. Thick, dark clouds are behind us and hours in front of us, the edge of the ice. Hunters pulled in a harpooned narwhal and then slaughter it while the body is still hot, leaving massive bloodstains on the ice. Indigenous Greenlanders are exempt from international whale hunting bans, but they're given catch limits on certain types of whales. Along with eating the meat, they're allowed to use whale parts to make and sell traditional handicrafts. There's a small drawing of a map of Greenland with Quanag, Q-A-A-N-A-A-Q, is at the top, and it's very near Thule, T-H-U-L-E, where the American Air Base is, I'm pretty sure is still there. And then down below, over the south of the Arctic Circle, is Nuuk, N-U-U-K. On the next page, Photographer's Notebook, 25 years ago, a trip to the edge in April would take about a day. Yesterday, Ilinquag's dog sled made it out there in less than 4 hours. And the caption says, a kayaker paddles Herbert Island in Baffin Bay. Older hunters say the ice there was much thicker and more stable in their youth. It's quite a beautiful, expansive picture, 2 pages wide, and you're looking from the edge of the ice to a brown mountain with one lone kayaker on the left side paddling. Next page, there's a picture of a hunter that was described earlier in the story. A hunter who lost his lower leg in frostbite. In the Arctic, it's all about nature's conditions, says Hendrik Saxgren, photographer of this story and author of the book Ultima Thule. Life is reduced to a yes or no. On the opposite page, we might call it a shack, but somebody lives there. A polar bear skin hangs outside a small house in Savissivik, Savissivik, a tiny island community in Melville Bay. Greenland Inuits as a whole were allowed by law to kill 92 polar bears in 2018. And the polar bear skin is prominent in the picture of the cabin. Another picture below it, an eerie grin of a skinned polar bear. As the Arctic climate warms, more bears are wandering into human settlements looking for food. Another double page photograph, photographer's notebook. There's little meaning in making a fuss. There's nothing else to do but say goodbye to the lost body part and continue your life with what parts may be left. It's a close-up picture of a Inuit man smoking a cigarette. An elderly hunter in Savissivik holds a cigarette between his ring finger and pinky. He lost his index and middle fingers to frostbite years ago. Two other people on the right. On the top, a hunter in the snow. To live in the Arctic, says Saxgren, you have to accept extreme cold as a different way to be present in the world. And below is a close-up of a woman in Savissivik prepares to sew animal skin. She's got thread hanging from her mouth. Traditional Inuit thread is made from the sinews of whales and other creatures. Next page is also a double page photo with water splashing up. The caption says, a fjord near the abandoned settlement in Moriusak, Moriusak, the tiny town used to have a store, a library, and internet access. In 2010, its last two residents moved to nearby Quanac. And the photographer's notebook says, according to myth, after the shaman's visit, the ocean is once again filled with hooded seals, bearded seals, harp seals, harbor seals, walruses, and narwhals. Up next, the last of the great American hobos. Hop a train to Iowa, where proud vagabonds gather every summer to hail the new king and queen of the rails. And there's a close-up picture of King Tuck, chosen as hobo monarch in 2007 and 2017, who today is 58, began his odyssey in 1988, leaving home in his 20s to ride the rails. There is a kind of late summer Midwestern sunset. Maybe you've seen one, so beautiful and so strange it's dislocating. From end to end, the whole sky goes pink rose. From end to end, the whole sky goes rose pink, and a giant sun hovers out there like a live coal over the corn. For a while, nothing moves. Not that sun, not the moon, not the stars. Time stops. It's dusk in farm country, coming up on twilight, but there's something of eternity in it. Not long ago, out in Britt, Iowa, they were watching that big sun hang behind the grain elevators while the orange light from the campfire flickered up in the hobo jungle. This is by the railroad tracks off Diagonal Street, just over from the cemetery and a couple of blocks down Main Avenue from the center of town. And after dinner, once the pots and pans are washed and stacked, the hobos will sit and smoke and sing a few choruses of what sounds like Hobo's Lullaby. Not far away, at the foot of the boxcar in the sinner's camp, they'll tell stories and drink beer in the lengthening shadows. Maybe 50 hobos in the jungle this year, and an equal number of hobo hobbyists and hobo historians and hobos at heart. Connecticut Shorty, Minnesota Jim, and Mystic Will, Slim Tim and Jump Off John, Sassy and Crash and Sunrise, Dutch and Half Track, and Iowegian, Tuck the King and Queen Minnesota Jewel, Gypsy Moon and Four Winds and Honeypot, Heather, Ricardo, and K-Bar, and New York Maggie Malone. Across from the boxcar, the outdoor kitchen and the equipment shed, and the little pavilion with the picnic tables. The big fire sits at the center of it all. The whole jungle, maybe an acre, is ringed by tents and cars and vans and little motorhomes. Almost no one rides the freight to get here anymore, way harder to catch out since 9/11, and harder still for an aging hopper. Jumping a train is still a dangerous act of sometimes desperate athleticism. Even in the firelight, it's an inventory of faded tattoos, gray ponytails, a vivid misremembrance, and missing teeth of crutches. Of crutches and sunburn and spotless denim. Of crutches and sunburn and spotless denim, of bulky hips and whiskey breath and nicotine stains. But there are children and grandchildren running around here too, and a few young hobos, gutter punks and dirty kids, and tourists and fans and citizens. There's even a group of students down from South Dakota State University. The whole place hums to life as day drains into darkness. Every hobo has a moniker, a nickname, grounded in habit or origin or appearance, like Redbird or Frisco Jack or Bookworm. Not every hobo wants to share his or her real name with the Straights and the Square Johns, of which, with my notebook and recorder and wingtip shoes, I am decidedly one. My hobo name is Searsucker. I wish I were kidding. A few, the ones trying to outrun something, won't even talk to me. So, monikers it is. As an editorial matter, know that I spoke to these folks and they spoke to me, that my bosses know that what's what, and that these interviews were accurately recorded and transcribed. And for the purposes of this story, I respect every hobo's right to anonymity. In a society of citizen consumers, to have nothing, to have nothing, to own nothing, by choice, might be the most radical politics of all. And it's worth mentioning here that not every homeless person is a hobo. And as the hobo fades from the American scene, except as a visual or literary cliché, there's more and more confusion on the matter. A hobo is homeless by choice. Even then, not every hobo is completely homeless. Most these days have a semi-permanent address somewhere for the winter, especially the older hoppers. Hobo slang can be intuitive or impenetrable, but it's always colorful. For example, the jungle is just a communal hobo camp, usually near the railroad yard. Your bindle is your bedroll. Your poke is your wallet. 100 on a plate is a can of beans. And the jungle kitchen is run by the crumb boss. The bulls are the railroad police. Flyers and hot shots and red balls are all fast freights. Catching out means hopping the train. To die is to catch the westbound. And understand this above all else, a hobo is an itinerant worker, someone who travels and finds work. A tramp travels, but mostly does not work. A bum neither travels nor works. And, of course, the whole thing runs on talk, endless talk. Because talk's free. Because even if you give away everything you own, or they take everything you have, you still have your stories. And every story here begins as the same story. Why I left home. Ricardo says, I did a lot of hitchhiking right after high school, and one time my brother was out hitchhiking in California, and some tramps got a hold of him and told him ride the trains instead of hitchhiking. And so he rode the trains. They came back, and that was in 1973. They were talking in a bar about riding out to see Evel Knievel jump the Snake River Canyon, and I started to listening to it, and I worked seasonal and stuff. I had some freedom there. I was in. And so my older brother, there was 11 of us, gone out of St. Cloud and hopping freight, and I fell in love with it right away. I mean, I like hitchhiking because you can get to meet a lot of different people. But the freight train riding was like the freedom, you know? Minnesota Jim says, I first left home when I was 16, just to see the country and get out on my own for a while to see if I could do it. And I did. And Gypsy Moon says, my father was a hobo, born in 1898 in Frog Level, North Carolina. Ran away from home when he was 12 or 13. Rode freights for about 17 years. He's a wonderful storyteller, musician, singer. He was always the one to tuck me in bed at night. He would say, two songs, one story. You get to choose one song, and I'll choose one. I always chose Cocaine Jubilee because he learned it out in the opium dens, and it was a funny song. Then he would sing one, and he'd tell me one of his adventure stories. I remember when he'd leave every night, I'd think, I can't wait until I'm old enough to do that. I started hitchhiking right out of high school and eventually was a student at Indiana University. I had the honor of doing a directed writing course, which I could choose the professor. He said, you need to choose a good topic. And I chose hobos. And I said, because I grew up with it. And K-Bar says, when I was a really young kid, I lived in a neighborhood in Houston, close to the big train yard. It had a hobo jungle there for a long, long time. I had a buddy named Dusty, and me and Dusty used to sneak out there in the field and watch the hobos. We used to watch the guys get on and off the trains all the time, so we kind of knew how it all worked. Dusty and I did catch a train to Galveston. We just got on the train in the dark. We got down there and we're like, we're 60 miles from home. How are we going to get back? Maybe half an hour later, there was a train going the other way, rolling real slow. We saw empties. We caught a train going the other way, and by sheer luck, it went right back to the same place we were at. We were just really lucky. Amy Bockelman, president of Brit Hobo Days Association, says, Brit is a small town in north central Iowa, maybe 2,000 souls, tidy lawns and houses, a handful of shops and restaurants, a few vacant storefronts, nice library and municipal building, and the police station used to be the dentist's office. Dan Cummings, the chief at the time, just brought in a new popcorn maker he's pretty happy with for the jail. 25 minutes east is Clear Lake, where Buddy Holly's plane went down. 25 minutes west is Algona, where the motels are, and the McDonald's, and the Hormel pepperoni plant, and the factory where they make Snap-on toolboxes. 10 minutes north is the Crystal Lake Wind Farm and its long horizon of bright white turbines. And 15 minutes past that is the Winnebago factory over in Forest City. Everything else this time of year is corn. Corn to the distant edges of the world. Corn and more corn. And the kind of immaculate farms for which Iowa is known. The train tracks run east-west through Brit. There's been a railroad in and out of here since about 1870. First hobo probably rode through not long after. Used to be a Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul line, then the Iowa, Chicago, and Eastern. Now it's the Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad, mainly freight trains carrying mostly grain. We're all here for the 118th National Hobo Convention, along with the county fair and the draft horse show. The Hobo Convention is the biggest thing on the Brit calendar. From what I have gathered over the years growing up in Brit, it started in 1900, where two businessmen had heard about this convention happening in Chicago, and they thought, why don't we go out there and see what it's all about? And maybe that's something we could bring to Brit, bring people into Brit and businesses. Ryan Arndorfer, mayor of Brit, Iowa. My favorite part is starting the week before there's a lot of hobos in town, and I try to go down to the jungle almost every night, up until like Wednesday and Thursday when we get really busy on the festival. But it's those nights in the jungle just talking that are some of the best. You hear old stories. Everyone's reminiscing. A lot of them will share stories of riding with some of those steam-era hobos who used to come to Brit and aren't here anymore. So it's finding that common connection, and they're so welcoming to people from the community, and they love sharing their stories. To me, that's what it's all about, and I've formed some great relationships with several of them now. The history of the hobo is the history of modern America. Starts right after the Civil War and the building of America's great railroads. There had always been a small floating population of agrarian workers, but they were limited by geography and technology. They were regional, local. Language historians and entomologists aren't sure, but the word hobo may come from this original population of farm workers, hoboys. The railroads change all that. After the war, there's an expanding displaced population available to ride and help build a transportation network running from coast to coast. As this is happening, America is industrializing, too. And the need for a mobile workforce, willing, adaptable, and relatively inexpensive to transport, becomes evident. The hobo. By the late 19th century, the heart of hobomania was the main drag in Chicago, where train lines radiated out into every corner of America. It was easy to find work there in the slaughterhouses to make a buck before you caught out again. Easy to go west and build a dam, or go east and take a job in a new steel mill. So for decades, it was America's hobo home. The hobo code was written there in 1894. An outline of ethical hobo practice and communal etiquette. Based in mutualism and self-respect, it remains every hobo's founding document, a simple and forthright set of instructions to live by. The same year, Coxey's Army of Unemployed makes its protest march on Washington. The country is growing in booms and busts, and transient work like lumbering and mining and seasonal fruit picking are moving west into parts of the country without much population, so the hobo follows. And in the same way coffee houses were indispensable to the American Revolution, railroads and hobos become an integral part of the modern U.S. labor movement, especially in the Pacific Northwest. Who else but Americans could drill through 10 tunnels in mountains 30 feet deep in snow? In 1969, Transportation Secretary John A. Volpe, addressing a crowd at Promontory Point, Utah, hailed the ingenuity and daring do that had revolutionized travel across the young nation. Who else but Americans, he asked, could chisel through miles of solid granite? 10,000 to 20,000 immigrant Chinese laborers had helped forge the Central Pacific's path over the Sierra Nevada to its historic 1869 meeting with the Union Pacific. I wish we had a little more time to finish that. We hope you've enjoyed today's edition of Smithsonian. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.